23-13142, Youngblood versus the City of Georgiana. We have Mr. Phillips here for the appellant, Mr. Everhart here for the appellee. Mr. Phillips, whenever you're ready, no hurry.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. Clay Phillips on behalf of Williams and Connolly, court-appointed counsel for Eric and Melissa Youngblood. For purposes of argument this morning, I'd like to focus on our two main issues, which is whether a warrant-issuing municipal magistrate is entitled to absolute judicial immunity, and second, whether an officer who executes a warrant that he knows is not supported by probable cause is entitled to the protections of qualified immunity. Now, I'd like to begin with whether Ms. Rogers is entitled to absolute judicial immunity. The Supreme Court has been exceptionally clear in case after case after case after case that the relevant question to determine whether a state official is entitled to absolute immunity is to ask whether that official would have enjoyed that level of immunity at common law in 1871 when Congress enacted Section 1983.
So let me ask you this, because I haven't done the work, but I suspect you may be right about the sort of your historical common law point, but it seems like you've got to deal with the 800-pound gorilla, which is Scott versus Dixon, right?
Well, Your Honor, Scott versus Dixon is just on its own terms nothing more than an application of two earlier decided, published, and binding decisions. Scott versus Dixon says, and I quote, says that the clerk at issue there, and I quote, falls within this circuit's narrow extension of absolute judicial immunity to court clerks. And then it immediately cites Williams versus Wood and Tarter versus Hurry, which are two earlier decided cases. And Wood and Tarter are very clear that there are only, and that's a direct quotation again, only two circumstances in which a clerk is entitled to absolute immunity. That's when the clerk is acting under the command of court decrees or acting at the explicit instruction or direction of a judge.
But Dixon then extends those to a different scenario, right? Where the clerk is acting in sort of a judicial capacity, making a judicial decision.
Well, Your Honor, two responses. I think the language of Scott versus Dixon is not extending those cases. It says that the clerk there falls within the extension as articulated in Wood and Tarter. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that the very narrow language of Wood and Tarter would leave open an extension. Again, Williams versus Wood says that there are only these two limited circumstances, and Tarter versus Hurry then follows that to say that for all other actions for damages, a clerk is entitled to only qualified immunity.
Yeah,
Dixon does look a lot like this case. I mean, it's the same weird scenario where the private party swears out the affidavit for the warrant, and then you've got this kind of clerk, non-judge, judge doing a judgy kind of thing and issuing the warrant. I mean, it looks awfully similar. Whether it's an extension of those earlier cases or just an application of them, I think I understand sort of the strategic move to try to force us back to the old cases, but so long as we're like just looking at Dixon, man, it seems close to me.
Well, Your Honor, I would concede that if we're just looking at Dixon, this would be a much more difficult argument, but we're not just looking at Dixon. We're looking at that line of cases, all of which contain a very coherent basis of reconciliation, which is that when a clerk or a magistrate acts with a judge's imprimatur, that clerk is entitled to the judge's immunity. And that is not this case where Ms. Rogers was acting.
So, well, let me just defend the broader proposition then, because I happen to think Dixon was right. So the whole point of having someone review a warrant application and determine that there was probable cause is that they are not doing an executive function. If an executive is doing it, then it's a problem, right? I mean, the thing that makes a warrant good from a constitutional perspective is that you've got some independent officer who's not serving in an executive capacity doing it. So why isn't it just inherently, you can call them a judge, you can call them like Willy Wonka, you can call them whatever you want to, but like if they're doing the warrant, then they're acting in a judicial capacity. Why isn't that just the right rule?
Well, Your Honor, we know that that's not the right rule because that's not the distinction that the common law drew in 1871. It's very well settled from
common law. Well, let's just assume I don't care about that.
Well, Your Honor, I would push back. I think that's the standard here, but I'll accept the premise. I do think that there are very important and different a very important differences between how a judge of a court of general jurisdiction performs his or her function and how a municipal magistrate or clerk like Ms. Rogers performs hers. I think most significantly, the Supreme Court in Malley versus Briggs explained that we extend absolute immunity to judges in part because they oversee, and prosecutors in that case as well, in part because they're involved over the entire life of a case or controversy. And the underlying principle is that if a judge is potentially liable for an early in time decision at a very early stage of the case, then that can shade how the judge continues to think about the case and can undermine his or her independence.
So the problem with that analogy, is judges actually don't grant search warrants and then preside over the case for the entire case. That's actually not what happens.
Well, Your Honor, that very well could
usually
be the case.
Usually, if you grant the search warrant, that means you don't actually preside over the case. You let some other judge do that because you've already basically determined that there was probable cause for the search, and so you let somebody else do it. As a matter of practice, that's usually what happens.
Well, Your Honor, again, I would just point this court back to the underlying principle here, which is, in these sort of absolute immunity claims, the question that the Supreme Court has told us to look for is to whether the given official is entitled to immunity in 1871. Now, Scott versus Dixon may obliterate that. I think that's not the case for the reasons that I've explained, because it's applying very narrow cases and it's confined to those circumstances. But we're not here to employ some sort of freewheeling policy determination of what the rule ought to be. We're applying what the rule is as the Supreme Court has told us, and as it existed in 1871, and those cases, again, are extremely clear. Our friends on the other side have pointed to zero common law cases that go in the opposite direction. So we can have a disagreement about whether that's a sound policy or whether that actually makes sense, but that's just simply not the relevant question. So, Your Honor, let's just
move on to why there is probable cause here. Why isn't there obviously probable cause? The district court said there was probable cause. Why isn't there probable cause? Why do we even have to address immunity?
Well, Your Honor, there was no probable cause of determination as to Ms. Rogers. That was dismissed on the motion to dismiss. So the immunity question and the probable cause of determination, we think, are separate inquiries. Now, there's facts in the record and allegations that would say that Ms. Rogers had actual knowledge that that there was no probable cause. That's in our complaint at paragraph 63.
Yeah, I'm just saying, why isn't there probable cause? Like, forget about immunity. Why isn't the fact that the victim of stalking went and swore out a warrant that said, this is what happened to me, I was the victim of stalking, why doesn't that satisfy the probable cause standard?
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court in District of Columbia versus Wesby said that we have to take a probable cause determination from a totality of the circumstances consideration. So we in our position is that Mr. Stallworth was a uniquely uncredible witness. We've got very good reasons for that, as I'm sure Your Honor is well on.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure about that. I mean, you seem to think he's not a credible witness because he's the victim of the stalking and because he was previously in a fight about that. Is that your point?
That's not our point, Your Honor.
What's your point?
So he accused our client, Mr. Youngblood, of harassment. That is based entirely on an altercation that took place on November 15th with some additional allegations that I will address. But the facts as stated in his affidavit that refer to that November 15th altercation are flatly inconsistent with better evidence of which Officer Benbow was certainly aware when he executed the warrant. So, for example, in his affidavit, Mr. Stallworth says that the altercation began when they crossed paths in an office, and Mr. Youngblood said, MF-er, I'm still going to kill you, and then, using the notorious passive voice, said that an altercation ensued. However, from we know from a third-party and neutral witness, her account of the same facts is that Mr. Youngblood simply said the word, hey. And then the altercation began because Mr. Stallworth began punching Mr. Youngblood in the face. So again, that's just one example of why that affidavit is not reliable to provide probable cause. And it's also undisputed in this case that the entire probable cause determination that supported Mr. Youngblood's arrest is based on that affidavit.
Right.
Now, there are additional allegations in that affidavit as well, which we believe are sufficiently undermined.
I thought the probable cause, though, was not to arrest based on the fight in the office, but was about what happened before the fight that led to the fight.
Well, Your Honor, there's only one allegation in the affidavit that refers to anything that happened prior to that altercation. And that is that Mr. Youngblood, on the morning of November 15th, there are two allegations, and I'll address both of them. The first is that on the morning of November 15th, Mr. Youngblood had brandished a handgun.
Right.
And we, I think, concede that in a vacuum, that allegation would be problematic. However, there is significant evidence in the record of which Officer Bimbo was aware that would make any reasonable officer at least have reasonable doubts about that. The first of those is that when Officer Bimbo arrived on the scene that same day, Mr. Stallworth guaranteed to him that Mr. Youngblood was still in a possession of a weapon and told him that it was in his car. Mr. Youngblood, with zero prompting from Officer Bimbo, invited him to search his person and his vehicle. Officer Bimbo did that, and there was no weapon present.
He didn't. I mean, I've watched the video, which was highly entertaining. But he didn't really search the car. He just walks over there and sort of looks in it, right? And how does the fact that Youngblood doesn't have the weapon a couple of hours later when the fight happens in the leasing office mean that he didn't use, you know, a weapon to intimidate, you know, hours earlier?
Well, Judge Brasher, doesn't conclusively establish that,
yeah.
And we concede that. However, again, this is a totality of the circumstances evaluation. There are no credible facts, as stated by Mr. Stallworth, that could have been verified that turned out to be true. There's only one, as stated, that was verifiable, and it turned out to be false. There's also, if Officer Bimbo had performed an investigation, he would have learned that Miss Youngblood did at one point in time own a handgun, but that handgun had been reported stolen to police months prior to this incident, and there's no evidence at all that Mr. Youngblood had access to a handgun whatsoever.
Can I ask you one sort of oddity to me about the malicious prosecution claim in this case? Typically, it's a cop who swears out the affidavit. And so our cases say, look, if the cop lied or made material omissions or whatever, then you've got a 1983, you've got a malicious prosecution against that guy. Here, though, you're suing not the guy who swore out the affidavit, maybe because you don't think he's subject to 1983, but instead you're suing the officer who executed the warrant. That just seems totally different to me.
Your Honor, I don't think that there's a material distinction between those two on the facts of this case, because we know that Officer Bimbo knew of all of the facts in the affidavit and knew that they did not suffice for probable cause and yet moved forward to execute the warrant.
So
in any
it's
event.
So it's sort of like because of like the serendipity or anti-serendipity that Bimbo happens to have been the guy who was there at the inception and then executed the warrant, that you have kind of this claim sort of holding together. And in a different circumstance, it might not work.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Yeah, I guess just to go back to the video and the sort of the encounter in the leasing office. From the perspective, just tell me why this is wrong. From the perspective of the police officer, the officer shows up. There are two guys fighting. He breaks them up. One guy, a stalwart, says the reason we're fighting is because he threatened me with a gun earlier in the day, and the officer actually tells him on the video, well, I can't arrest him for that, but if you go and you sign out a warrant in front of the magistrate, then I can arrest him. And then the guy that he arrests does exactly what he says. He says he goes in front of the magistrate judge. He swears out that this event happened and that's what led to the fight. And then the officer comes and arrests him. How has the officer done anything that's obviously problematic in light of that scenario?
Your Honor, and this will actually address a bit of Judge Newsom's previous question as well. This is just like Tillman versus Coley, where the officer didn't exactly swear out the warrant himself, but then executed one based on facts that he knew were not true. To Judge Brasher, to your specific question, again, it is just not reasonable to credit the allegations from Mr. Stallworth in this circumstance, where everything that he said that is provable or not provable was proven to be not true. And we have other record evidence that undermines this.
But that was later, though, right? I mean, you've attacked his allegations later. The officer has the two guys fighting. One guy says it started with this previous crime that was committed against him. That's all he knows, right?
Well, I don't think that that's a fair characterization, Judge Brasher.
Yeah, I mean, explain what's wrong about it.
Yeah,
I'm just trying to figure out what's
wrong. Officer Bimbo would not have made the determination that Mr. Stallworth was the aggressor in the incident.
No. Look, I see my boys fighting all the time. And one of them has gone over and hit another one. And then when I say, why did you do that? He said, because yesterday he did this thing to me. That doesn't mean that the one who was attacked was the aggressor because he did something yesterday. And that's exactly the scenario here. I don't understand the idea that because, one person can commit a crime against another person and be the aggressor, But the second one could have committed a crime against him at a previous point, right? I don't understand that.
Well, I guess in theory that's correct, Your Honor. I would again.
What about in practice? What about in this case?
Yeah. So I would just again urge that there is nothing that Mr. Stallworth has said to this point to give him any credence. This court has said that the probable cause of determination has to be based on trustworthy information. There's no reason to accord that level of trust to the words of Mr. Stallworth when he has not said anything that can be verified that turned out to be true. And I see that I'm well over my time.
No, very well. We held you over, so you've got your full 3 minutes of rebuttal time. Mr. Everhart, let's hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Brad Everhart. I represent Chief Carlton Cook of the Georgiana Police Department, Assistant Chief Jeremy Pagler, Officer Will Benbo, and the City Magistrate, Beverly Rogers. The City of Georgiana, I think, is still a nominal party in this case, but I think my colleagues have conceded they're no longer pursuing any claims against the City of Georgiana. The last point that you hit, I think it's important for the court. I want just, for purposes of emphasis, to read Mr. Stallworth's sworn statement that he provided to the magistrate, because there's been a lot of discussion trying to corner that into this is all related to the first incident when it clearly was not. This is the statement. This is a sworn statement given to the magistrate under oath in the complaint. This incident occurred at Wood Glen Apartments in Georgiana. On November 15, 2018 at 6:30 a.m., I came out of my apartment for my daily walk. I seen Eric Youngblood, riding through the parking lot. He made eye contact with me, then reached down to his side and pulled out a revolver handgun and brandished it at me. I immediately retreated back to my apartment. I walked over to the apartment manager's office. I walked in, and Eric was on his way out of the office. As he passed me, he said, "Motherfucker, I'm still going to kill you." At that time, him and I got into an altercation. Now, Eric has made threats about killing me in the past. I also noticed when I was at the clerk's office, he rode by following me, and I pointed it to the clerk. I just want the harassment and the following to stop. That was 6 days after the event that my colleagues have referenced. So it quite clearly was not related to the one incident. On this, there's this continuing argument from the appellants that Officer Benbow should have done a further investigation. Well, that's not required. In fact, they've not pointed to a case that says that's required and it isn't. And I can't remember the case, but I think it was Justice Scalia in one of his dissents said something to the effect that what the appellant is really advocating is that officers, police officers, act as pseudo-appellate courts, scrutinizing every judge's arrest warrant. Well, that's not required, and it would cause problems, I think we all know.
You're talking now about the malicious prosecution claim against Benbow?
I'm sorry.
Are you talking now about the malicious prosecution?
Exactly. Yeah, well, okay. The argument that there was no at least arguable probable cause for Officer Benbow, that he should not have believed this warrant because would happen days earlier. But again, the warrant itself was issued by a neutral magistrate based on not what happened 6 days ago, but what happened before that altercation and after that altercation. I'm sure you can have a picture of it. He said to the person he was swearing the warrant out to, "This guy's following me and there his car is right there." That's harassment. It quite clearly is. And I want to reiterate, not only did the local municipal court find that there was probable cause, the magistrate who swore out the warrant believed that there was probable cause, and then the district court believed that there was probable cause. And not arguable probable cause, which is all we have to prove in order to be entitled to qualified immunity, probable cause.
Yeah, and if we just say that there's probable cause here, then we don't have to address the judicial immunity stuff, we don't have to address the qualified immunity stuff. We just say, look, if you look at the warrant, based on what this witness says, that's probable cause, and that's all we have to worry about, right?
Well, and just a reminder that under Supreme Court precedent, a victim's statement, sworn statement, is assumed to be true for purposes of probable cause determination.
Yeah, look, you can convict someone of rape based on just the victim's statement, right? You can convict someone of all sorts of stuff based on the victim's statement.
And I would even go a step further, Judge Brasher. I think that you could determine if there's even arguable probable cause in this case, everybody gets out. And that's all you need to do. Frankly, Scott v. Dixon is pretty much on squares with this case. A little bit different because it's an Atlanta clerk of court, I'm sorry, a Georgia clerk of courts rather than an Alabama clerk magistrate, okay? Frankly, I think under the circumstances, our magistrate probably has a higher level of protection than a court clerk might under those circumstances. My colleague wants to focus on, and I think Judge Brasher hit this point, you can call him Mr. Magoo, call him whoever you want. But what is happening here is the person is making a probable cause determination. And that is a so uniquely judicial function. That is covered by absolute immunity. But your honors don't need to even reach that point because remember, the district court's decision can be upheld for any reason, right for any reason, as long as supported by the record. And the record supports that there was at least arguable probable cause. And for that reason alone, you don't have to reach the decision about whether or not this conflicts with Scott v. Dixon.
So they say that there's something in that warrant application that the officer knew not to be true. And I guess it's the sort of how the fight in the leasing office started is kind of what they're pointing to and saying, look, the officer knew that the fight in the leasing office didn't really start that way because the officer identified Stallworth as the aggressor. And I sort of belittled that argument a little bit, but it's not that bad of an argument. So what do you think about that?
I would say this. I don't know that my colleagues have pointed anything out in the sworn statement that is not true. It talks about what happened at the incident where there was an altercation between them in the apartment complex, but I don't think there's anything in there that's untrue. But again, arguable probable cause is all we have to prove. And there clearly was arguable probable cause. Again, three different tribunals up to this point have found probable cause, not even arguable probable cause. And that's all we need to show to be entitled to qualified immunity. But I do believe, and I think this court should hold, that a city magistrate in Alabama is entitled to absolute immunity. Because, you know, my colleague accuses us of being Chicken Little. The sky is falling, societal stability. But I want the court to remember that absolute immunity is not for the judge. It's for the public. It's to uphold the public's interest in making sure that we don't have every disgruntled litigant suing every judge who issues a search warrant.
Is there any limit in your mind to the Willy Wonka, Mr. Magoo proposition that, like, just whoever happens to be there, maybe they're in third grade and they're issuing warrants, they're entitled to judicial immunity? Is there any limit to that proposition?
There's a limit, of course, Judge. I mean, they have to be statutorily authorized, number one. You know, and magistrates and city magistrates in Alabama are statutorily authorized. They derive that authority from the Alabama Constitution of 1901. And to diverge a little bit, you know, we've talked about the historical context, and we can almost concede maybe a city magistrate under English common law in the 1700s, maybe they weren't entitled to absolute immunity, but they didn't exist under English common law. And your honors all know that. I mean, there's plenty of commentators who have questioned the historical basis for qualified immunity. But we haven't thrown that out. The case law has developed since 1871. And for all those reasons, all the reasons that we have qualified immunity, we have all these immunities, it's still viable to this point. And there's no reason to draw a distinction between a clerk in Georgia, like in Scott versus Dixon, and a city magistrate under Alabama law. And I'll remind the court, too, that there are other cases from other circuits, Fourth Circuit, Eighth Circuit, that have reached almost the same decision. So you need to understand that if you were to find, as my colleague wishes this court to find, I believe it would cause a conflict, not even just in this circuit with Dixon, but with other circuits that have held similarly. I'll yield the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Okay, very well. Mr. Phillips, you've got 3 minutes of rebuttal time.
Mr. Phillips, what should Officer Benbow have done when the magistrate judge issued the arrest warrant and said, go execute this warrant?
Your Honor, on the facts of this case, where the summary judgment record read in our favor and drawing all inferences in our favor, where Officer Benbow knew that there was no probable cause, we think that it is not unreasonable that he should not execute the warrant and should instead return that warrant to the issuing magistrate to explain the facts within his knowledge that undermine the probable cause determination. Now,
we're assuming that he read the arrest warrant. The judge says, go execute this warrant. And so there's an obligation on the part of the officer to review it for probable cause, a second probable cause determination, and then go back to the magistrate judge?
Your Honor,
there's no precedent for it. I'm not aware that there's any precedent for that.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to speak over you. There is no precedent for that. That's also not our position. Our position isn't that an officer should kick the tires on the probable cause determination and make a legal or determination whether the facts as stated suffice for probable cause. That is the province of the judge or the magistrate that issues the warrant. However, when the facts as stated in the affidavit prove to be not true and therefore do not support a probable cause determination.
In his view, if he thought that the warrant did not support probable cause, what are you saying his obligation was to do?
So I'm attempting to draw a distinction, and I want to make sure that I understand the question, Your Honor. Okay. If he looks at the face of the warrant and says, you know, geez, this is tough. I don't necessarily agree that this suffices for probable cause, but the magistrate said it did, then he should execute that warrant because he should defer to the magistrate. That is a legal judgment that I would say is the province of the magistrate. If the facts underpinning the warrant, however, that the executing officer happens to be in possession of knowledge that the facts as stated are flatly not true, that is a different and factual determination, and he does have the authority to not execute the warrant. I will point out that the Alabama Code requires a magistrate, an officer to execute a warrant that's been issued by a municipal judge. It does not have that same shall execute language that attaches to a warrant that's issued by a magistrate, so that option was open to him. We don't think that he had an affirmative obligation to return it to the magistrate, so we're not imposing that next step, but he could have simply not executed it. We think it would have been a sort of logical next step, especially considering that he took Mr. Youngblood to Ms. Rogers' office to execute the warrant, to explain that to her, but we're not saying that he had that affirmative obligation to take. Your Honor, I do want to just clear up one thing, and perhaps this gets to Judge Brasher's question as well. Following under just Alabama harassment is not a violation, so whether he was at the courthouse when the warrant was executed, it just could not have supported a probable cause of determination, so I just wanted to clear that one point up in my final 10 seconds. Thank you.
Very good, Mr. Phillips. Thank you so much. I know that you're court-appointed. We certainly appreciate your service. Thank you to Williams and Connolly for taking the case. All right, that case is submitted, and on to the last case of the day.